Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Well, we're back from Turkey Day, four-day holiday weekend. Hope everybody had a great time with friends and family, a very relaxing time, and hopefully those belt loops are holding in the effects of all the great food that I saw across social media. And, of course, my co-host, Stan Friedman, is with us from Atlanta, not traveling for once. Stan, how are you today?
Well, I was feeling pretty good until you just went through the belt loop dialogue there, Paul, as I'm finishing munching down on a terrific Jimmy John's Pepe sandwich here, and you're talking about all the notches on the belt. I'm feeling twice as guilty as I did before.
I polished off the last little piece of apple pie this morning. I told my wife I was having fruit for breakfast. She said, "Fruit? We don't have any fruit in the house." I said, "Yes, we do. We have a last piece of apple pie." So.
I'll tell you the thing that we did this year that made the greatest of sense, and it helps to expedite getting through those leftovers, is we had our family feast on Thursday, and then on Saturday we had Friendsgiving, and we invited some neighbors over to help us plow through those leftovers. So that we only got a small portion of what was left. We kind of shared it and spread the wealth a little bit with some people who had been elsewhere for Thanksgiving, didn't have many leftovers of their own. So it helped us clear out the fridge a little bit quicker, and it left a little bit of room for me to knock back that Jimmy John's today.
That sounds good. It sounds good. Well, you know, with Thanksgiving weekend, we have Black Friday. You know, the stores were packed. And, of course, we had Small Business Saturday by American Express. I believe it's about 5 years into that program. And anybody, of course, that's been following me on social media for the last 5 years knows I get pretty passionate about reminding everybody to not only shop small and local, but shop franchise. And although we've made significant progress over the years with American Express, getting them to recognize that franchises are small business owners as well, just like any other mom and pop on Main Street USA, same risk, same competition, same wishes, hopes, and dreams. I mean, they are the same small business owners. And still, we have American Express putting a very, very stiff limit on the number of franchise locations that a brand can have before they'll allow them into the program. And of course, if some of you remember 5 years ago, that wasn't even the case. Franchises were excluded, and I went, you know, berserk because I was referring so many of our clients into the Small Business Saturday program, only to find out franchises weren't allowed. And it wasn't until the actual day of the event 5 years ago, and I went all over Twitter, and this was after being interviewed by the Wall Street Journal and Inc. magazine and Entrepreneur magazine, that couldn't believe what was actually going on. And I went on Twitter and said that franchises should just stop immediately taking the American Express card. And I promptly got a message on Twitter from a senior VP at American Express asking me to call her. We had a great conversation, and I met with 13 senior executives of American Express shortly afterwards. And I was really amazed, Stan, that they just didn't understand franchising the model. They thought basically franchising was McDonald's. They were these big corporate behemoths. They were even had the misperception that McDonald's paid for all the advertising that is done at the local level. It was just one miscue after another. And I think that's still carrying on today, not only with American Express, but, you know, obviously City Council up in Seattle and other federal agencies that really don't understand franchising the way it is. So anyway, all the people that supported franchising and shopped franchise on Small Business Saturday, I really thank you. I thank you for all your kind words, your encouragement, as I really went on a barrage again, just trying to have people recognize franchising as the great small business that it is.
You know, Paul, you got me sitting here thinking as you're just sharing that with us. I wonder if anyone at IFA has tried to solicit the help of American Express in helping places like Seattle and other cities in New York and others that have tried to fall in behind its minimum wage decision and unfair treatment of franchising. I just wonder if American Express might be able to help open some eyes to those, because clearly they didn't get the difference between franchising and small business too clearly themselves until somebody helped them understand that franchising is too part of small business, doesn't need to be treated like a big Wall Street giant entity. I wonder if they could help us maybe articulate that message and get that out there in a way that we're just not getting it done by ourselves.
Yeah, disappointingly, IFA has taken a back seat in this effort, even 5 years ago when the VP, executive VP, contacted me. I reached out to IFA and literally wanted to hand it over to them. And they basically said no, they weren't interested at that time. And a couple of years later, Tom Epstein and I, who's also been a big promoter of shop franchise, him and I got on the phone with some IFA staff and discussed it and tried to invite American Express to the IFA convention the following year and really tried to get them to understand. And again, it went on deaf ears. And sadly, you know, as I said, you know, very strong in social media, so I see a lot of interactions. I interact with a lot of people. I track the likes, I track the engagement, and I didn't have a single retweet, share, like on anything that we did for a week solid from the IFA. So for some reason or another, they're just staying at arm's length away from this. And
well, I don't know.
I can't say
because that was then, Paul. That was then, Paul, and this is now, and there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. So I don't know. It's worth probably asking somebody in GR at IFA if that would be another avenue to help us. I mean, we're all looking for different ways to get the messages out there now. So just because it was no then, maybe just like somebody who's looking to acquire a franchise says no, they say no for now.
Yep.
You know,
change
a little bit later.
Yeah, I don't disagree, especially with new leadership and new focus moving forward. Like I said, it was even last week that there wasn't a single interaction. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you know, and like you said, it's a new time. We're moving forward, and certainly I'm not going to give up on my efforts on Small Business Saturday for franchising. So certainly we'll be having that conversation.
Well, speaking of not giving up on efforts, I'd love to bring something to the audience's attention. The meter is running, the clock is ticking, and December 11th could be an early Christmas gift for all of us involved in franchising. And I'm going to ask everybody who hasn't yet noted to jump into your inbox sometime today and take a look at the IFA Insider that was issued yesterday. And even if you've missed that, the personal email that's in your inbox today from Aziz Hashim, vice chair of the IFA. And what he's doing is what IFA Insider did yesterday. It's calling your attention to the fact that the clock is ticking. And on December 11th, Congress is going to vote on an omnibus bill for the year-end funding of the government to approve appropriations for the federal government. And as part of that bill, there is an opportunity to protect local business and to bring the Protecting Local Business Opportunity Act into that bill. Bottom line is, you can write a letter today with one mouse click or two on your laptop. If you go into the IFA Insider from yesterday or into Aziz Hashim's email to you today, there are live links within both. And those live links will take you to a template of a letter that you can send on behalf of yourself through the voice of the IFA and the Coalition to Save Local Businesses, and basically tell your members of Congress to support any end-of-year spending measures that include language to reverse the recent NLRB decision and preserve the traditional definition of joint employer for the coming year. It's only a mouse click or two. I did it this morning. It will take you 2 minutes or less. And what you will do is guarantee the small business owners that your livelihood will not be threatened by the National Labor Relations Board's recent Browning Ferris decision back in August. This can reverse it for next year. And the letters are already written. They're templated. All you do is click your zip code into the body of the letter, and it will automatically address itself to your elected officials. You can read the letter that will go out with your name on it before it sends, so you don't have to worry that something is being said that you don't abide by. And with a simple mouse click or two, this is the second biggest thing that you can do to impact what's going to become of franchising, second to going up to Capitol Hill every year as we do in the fall for FAN and for the Franchise Appreciation Day. This is your opportunity to have your voice heard. This is your opportunity to have your local legislator hear from you as a local business owner in your community speaking for the voice of franchising as a whole to make certain that we get this Browning-Ferris decision reversed. December 11th is the day. It's the day of the vote. And emails between now and then could mean early Christmas presents for all of us in franchising. So please, please take a minute or two to either click into the IFA Insider, which you'll find in yesterday's email in your inbox, or today's email from Aziz Hashim. The live links are in both places, and it will take no more than a minute or two of your time to make a big, big difference in the lives of all of us that are franchise-centric.
Thanks, Stan. I mean, that's some great information. I'm glad they did a 1-2 punch, because it would have been very easy to miss one. And I'm glad they put the links in there, make it very, very simple, and you're right. If this gets taken care of, it will be an early Christmas from all of us. And this is just, you know, all the ways of paying it forward, doing your part. And I read an interesting thing from some of the information that we were able to gather on today's guest, John Francis. And he says, today I pay it forward by offering my perspective, experience, advice, and connections to select franchisees, franchisors, and suppliers so that they can see what they don't see and achieve their highest levels of success. And as I said, Stan, you know, John Francis, well-known to all of franchising and well-known to us as our guest today. John, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Stan. Nice to join you, fellas. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
So I've got a fast question right out of the gate, Paul, before we get into the meat of today's conversation. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, go right ahead.
So, Johnny Franchise, come on. Johnny Franchise, where did that come from? And I love it, because I would rather be Johnny Franchise than Johnny Football, right?
Well, you know, and thank you, Stan. I'll tell you what, I'm not a big sports guy, right? I'm not a big sports fanatic. So I'd heard of Johnny Football, and I guess it's some guy's name, nickname, right? And
right.
So Johnny Franchise... I earned that nickname here in Minneapolis. It really started with a guy named Brian Schnell, who I'm sure you fellas both know. He's a lawyer here in Minneapolis. He's been in franchising forever. And you know, my name, Francis, is F-R-A-N-C-I-S. And I used to say, well, you can't say franchise without Francis, right? Because the letters are in the word. And so he said when he sees me, he thinks of me as Johnny Franchise. And we were at an event, and it was, what you know, like when everyone's getting together and kind of their first reception or whatever, and there was maybe, you know, 30 or 40 people. I think it was maybe one of those FBN, like a lunch program, you know, pretty small, informal. And he comes up, and everyone's kind of saying their hellos, and he says, Johnny Franchise. And everyone turned around and looked, and it was me, and I'm laughing, and we're shaking hands, and he says, you know, every time I see you, I think Johnny Franchise. And then everyone around kind of chimed in and started with, like, making jokes about it and everything, and it just kind of stuck. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not, I guess, you know, I think of the term Johnny Franchise, as far as I understand it, it means someone who's good at it, who can do kind of anything with it. I consider myself a good utility player. You know, drop me in, and I'll figure it out, and I'll do the best I can with whatever it is. So, I at a point I was kind of reluctant to use it because I think it's kind of, I don't know, kind of silly, kind of funny, goofy, and I don't consider myself really that creative or smart. You know, I show up, I do my thing, I try to help. You know, and But anyway, people said to me, well, you should use it because nobody else can. You know, Johnny Franchise, you should be that guy. So I said, okay.
I kind of liked it. I kind of liked it before I knew where it came from. Now that I know it came from Schnell, I like it even more.
Yeah, well, so I've embraced it, and I guess it's, you know, why not? I mean, it suits me, I guess, as long as my understanding is reasonably accurate. You know, the expectation it sets is like, hey, this guy knows what he's doing. So.
Well, Paul, we've got so many places that we could go in our conversation with a guy who's been both, you know, on the Zor side, on the Z side, on the advisory council, sits on boards. Open it up for us, Paul. Where do we start?
Well, you know, I think the big thing here is I'm really looking forward to John's perspective on the issues that you even opened up with, you know, NLRB, $15 an hour minimum wage, and what have you, because, you know, John, as a board member and advisor to a number of prominent, you know, franchise organizations, and, of course, a wealth of experience as a former franchisee and franchisor himself, you know, I think he brings to the table a point of view from, you know, both the executive office as well as from the front line, where I think a lot of others, you know, come in somewhere in the middle. So, you know, having grown up in the industry, and I'd like, you know, John to give us a little bit of insight, give our listeners a little bit of insight into his background and how he got started in franchising. I think his perspective is one that we need to hear. So, John, why don't you start us out with, you know, how you started in franchising. I know there are family ties there, but I think a lot of people don't know the entire story.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Paul. And I think you're right. You know, I'm one of those guys. There's a few other folks around who've been around long enough, have had experience on the franchisor side and the franchisee side and even on the supplier side. You know, I've been around it my whole life. So I don't, you know, I don't consider myself as really that unusual. I mean, maybe it's a little unusual, but there's certainly other folks that have a, you know, range and depth and years of experience like I do. So, but my history started with my family's business. So, I mean, a lot of people know me from different eras, I would say, different chapters in my life, in my career, and they, when they hear about some of the other chapters, they're like, oh, I had no idea that you did all that, too. So it's kind of funny, but I grew up as the son of a wild entrepreneur. My dad, Joe Francis, started a hair salon franchise company back in the 60s. You can believe that. He was a barber, cutting hair one head at a time here in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he was frustrated. He said, this is going to take forever. You know, how is this going to work? One at a time. So he looked around, and long story short, I mean, he studied the industry and realized that there really wasn't anything, you know, that he could do beyond own multiple stores. So he did. He opened, he created a new brand, a new upscale concept, and he opened himself as an owner, a proprietor, and he had 5 barbershops. And at the time, he was doing great, making good money and working his tail off. And then someone said, why don't you franchise this? I think it was actually some of the store managers who said, you know, we want a piece of the action. We see what's going through here, and how do we participate? And he said, well, hold on, let me find a way. So he went back, came back. Someone said, why don't you franchise that thing? And he said, what's that? You know, at the time, in the 60s and early 70s, there were restaurants and gas stations and hotels, but there wasn't, you know, it wasn't as prevalent in services especially. So he created a franchise model, and they started franchising barbershops. The brand was called The Barbers, and it was a high-end hairdressing salon, I guess, for men and women, and, you know, it was a big deal. It worked. So his first managers became his first franchisees. So they were franchising hair salons to barbers, and it worked. You know, they had some success, and these guys went around the upper Midwest here, based out of Minnesota, and they opened their salons, and it worked. And then they struggled. You know, they had their typical challenges with marketing and cash flow and all the different things. They got into beauty products and salon supplies and retailing. And I mean, they really expanded the business in a lot of different dimensions. And my dad, being the kind of entrepreneur that he was, decided this is a great opportunity to take the company public. So back in those days, it was, I think, relatively easy to, there was a local over the market, over the counter market here in the Twin Cities. They called it the Pink Sheets. It's like a local thing, mm-hmm. and I don't think it exists anymore today, but it sounds like it may be coming back with some of this crowdfunding stuff. But so they raised a bunch of money, and he sold off a bunch of shares, and most of it was the stylists and the customers in the shops that were buying the shares. Anyway, he raised the money, and then they expanded like crazy and made all the classic mistakes. They went too far, too fast, with no infrastructure, no plans. He was flying all over the country, you know, trying to pull this thing off. And again, long story short, through the 70s, they survived all that growth, and they managed to recruit and retrain. You know, they hired some professionals, marketing people, not barbers. You know, they hired finance people, not hairdressers. You know, they added the professionalism, and the management team grew, and the franchisees responded and really stepped up and did what they had to do to operate and run and evolve and grow the brands. And I mean, it was a labor of love. A lot of people were involved. My mom and dad were the founders and the leaders, and they, you know, they pushed and pulled and did everything they could to grow a brand and a system of success, and it worked. And so again, I was a kid growing up. When I was a kid, I thought everything was a franchise, and I thought everybody worked for themselves, you know, except the people that worked for my dad. So I didn't know much else. I thought, you know, everybody was entrepreneur. But in the 70s, the system really grew and became a national brand, and they had salons on all over the, you know, I don't know how many, 25 states or something, and they were growing, and it was coming together, and they were hitting that tipping point where the economies of scale were starting to pay off, and franchisees were building multiple stores. Barbers were millionaires, and they were taking the money out of their salons and buying real estate and buying other investments and really building a substantial business. So my dad created a path for these hairdressers to not only own the salon that they had, but own multiple salons and really leverage the work and effort of the whole brand. So he was recognized a couple different ways as a pioneer in franchising and an innovator in the salon industry and the barber industry. My mom and dad are in the Hall of Fame at the IFA for the innovations and things they helped bring through the franchise model. And then also he's in the Hall of Fame of the Barber Association as a barber, someone who helped change the industry in his lifetime. So that's what I grew up with. You know, we all, as a family, I'm the youngest of five kids, so we all had plenty of work to do. And he had all kinds of different businesses. He had the salon business and the franchise business. He owned a lot of real estate and, you know, all kinds of other stuff that came and went. And some were successful and some were failures. And we learned from a lot of great experience. And it was a tremendous amount of work, but a tremendous amount of fun to be able to work with my dad. So in the 80s, when I was in high school and college and growing up and really understood what, you know, what was going on here, the company had grown pretty sizable. I remember when we launched the Cost Cutters brand, was in 1982, was the value price quick service, you know, kind of like a Supercuts. And not ironically, but the guys who started Great Clips were from our company and started at the same time with the same concept. And so all of those brands kind of emerged at the same time in the early 80s when, you know, inflation was crazy and people were looking for quick service and families, and it was a couponing, and, you know, it was kind of a different retail environment. So in the 80s, the Cost Cutters brand really grew like crazy, and we franchised that, and we engineered that as a multiple unit brand for the franchisees. That was one of the things we innovated was the development agreements, where you would buy a territory and build five stores in the city, or those kind of things were new and innovations that our brand, our company, helped, you know, develop and gain experience, and other brands learned from that. And it was some of the innovations that we brought into the franchise world was those kind of development strategies. So in the 80s, it was the Barbers, and then Cost Cutters was our brand. Then we developed another brand called City Looks, which was more of a, you know, the Barbers was kind of a masculine, you know, who goes to a barber anymore? I mean, back in the 80s, you know, everyone wanted chrome and neon. And you know, so the City Looks was an upscale salon spa concept that was kind of a high-end thing. We had a bunch of those. And then we did some acquisitions. We started buying small regional brands of hair salons that we'd roll in and convert into our brands. Usually they'd convert to Cost Cutters or City Looks. Those were kind of our two main brands. Then in the 90s, I got out of college and went to work at the corporate office and the franchisor, and I had grown up in the office. I'd been at, grew up sweeping the warehouse and in salons my whole life. In the 90s, we took it international and did some international franchising. We took our salon concepts into Europe and did a master franchise with a French company and did, I think it was four countries in Western Europe. As a master franchise, we developed almost 50 salons over there over a few years, and then also spent time in Russia. At the time, it was the Soviet Union, and I was in Moscow in August of 1991 when the whole coup thing happened. I happened to be there trying to negotiate a joint venture. We had a Russian partner, and we were building an upscale salon, kind of a flagship facility there that we used as a training center and product distribution. And anyway, we had a joint venture in Russia that went on for years and some wild international activity, and then came back domestic, and we did more acquisitions. And we rolled up a brand in, I want to say it was 97, called We Care Hair, which was, I think it was about 150 stores. It was based in Chicago. It was 13 states. And I was in charge of that acquisition and integration of that brand into our system. And it was a big deal for us at the time. I think we had about 500 salons maybe, and we bought another 150. And that took, it was a two-year project that I got to lead that effort of integrating those franchisees and that brand and converting and handling all of the complexities of that. It was a great experience. Then, prior to that, my father, Joe, had passed away in 94. He had cancer. He had a long battle with cancer, which is a whole other story. But when he passed away, my mother, Flo, took over as chairman, she said, but she's a woman. And we had an outside management team. We had a very strong board of directors. We had since transitioned up on the public, the shares and the shareholders. Now we were a NASDAQ-listed company in the 90s, and we really started pushing the pedal to the floor. And the growth in the 90s was pretty dramatic. Again, the international took off, the domestic took off, the acquisitions were taken off. Everything was kind of working. In the 90s was a lot of fun, a lot of work. And I had an older brother who was a franchisee. He was 10 years older than me, Joe Jr., right? He's the older son, my brother. He died in a car accident in 97. Which, of course, is completely unexpected. And he was a franchisee, and, of course, he's my brother and the family and everything else. My mother went through a process of grieving and depression, and she came out of that and said, you know what, I want to retire. And this was in 98 when she kind of got through that. And, okay, so the board said, all right, we'll go through a plan. We were going to do a secondary offering. We were going to sell off some of my mother's shares so she could afford to retire. And it was, we had a plan. We went through the SEC and got everything filed and listed, and then it turned into an auction. We had private equity companies that wanted to buy the whole company. We had competitors that were making offers and saying, well, geez, we'll buy it. We don't want to buy just these shares. We want to buy the whole thing. And again, long story short, we went through this evaluation process. The board was very responsible. They said, well, we've got to pursue these opportunities, and we went back and forth. We wound up with three different, I would say, suitors who were trying to make offers and sweeten the deal. We wound up selling the whole organization into Regis Corporation. Regis Corporation is, again, based here in Minneapolis, a huge company at the time, even huge, larger than they are. I don't know how they were today, but in 99, we sold them just over 1,000 stores was our system size. I think we were 1,050 or something. We were opening stores like crazy, and we integrated the whole thing. We became a merged, technically a merger, but practically an acquisition. And we became the franchise division of the Regis company. And Regis at the time had 4,000 salons, and we sold them another 1,000. And then they went on to continue to grow and acquire all kinds of brands in the salon industry. And our group, what was the Barbers, the company that my family had and I worked my whole life, we became kind of their franchise division. A lot of our people, because we were primarily a franchise company, where Regis was primarily a corporate store system. So I went to Regis And I did what I said I would do, which was integrate the organization. And I knew, you know, a lot of things about everybody and the history of all the franchisees. And we had a lot of what you would say blended markets. We had some territory conflicts. I mean, we had some issues, you know, when you merge that big of a brand into another one that was even bigger. I mean, there was certainly things to sort out. I worked at Regis for about 9 months in 1999. I left Regis in November 99 when I had a negotiated a pretty neat deal, a severance agreement, a employment contract and everything else. So I left the company that I never thought I'd leave. You know, when I was a kid and I was working hard, I thought maybe one day I would run the family business. And I was on track, working hard, had a plan, had incentives, had goals, and everything on track. But things changed. You know, life changes. Reality comes through, and all of a sudden we sold the company. Oh, my God. I go to work for Regis. This is not the same. Clearly, it was not the same company. So I made my decisions, made my analysis, and I left Regis. Left on very good terms. Still actually have friends there. In fact, I was just emailing earlier this morning with a friend of mine who still works at Regis. So I've got some friends there. I mean, it's a small industry. And
oh, boy,
small town.
For sure that's true. For sure that's true.
Yeah.
And
I took off the year 2000, kind of just decompressed. And I got involved in a brand called PostNet as an area developer and a regional, what I would call a regional representative, an area franchisee in their parlance. But I bought the territory for Minnesota and Wisconsin and opened a unit as a franchisee and then started promoting and supporting franchisees in my territory. And I spent the next 10 years from 2001 till 2011 as a multi-unit franchisee and an area developer for that PostNet brand, which at the time started in Henderson, Nevada, but they moved their headquarters to Denver. And I did, I think, about everything you could do as a franchisee with that brand. Had a great experience. PostNet's a great company, great leadership, very competitive retail, storefront, strip center, real estate. You know, a lot of the practical aspects that I learned about the hair salon business were transferable to that model in terms of retail and real estate and marketing and consumer and services and products and all the rest. So I had a lot of fun with PostNet and did that. Like I said, in 10 years, I developed 17 stores, and five of those were my own that I owned, and I would build them and sell them and convert them. I did some pretty interesting things as a franchisee. Got very involved in the IFA there as a franchisee, even though I had grown up at IFA as a franchisor through our family's business. So then in early 2000s, I got invited to help as I guess opportunities started coming my way. And I started doing some what I would call lightweight consulting. So I never really fancy myself as a know-it-all or a real expert. If I can help, I try to help. So I was doing some consulting with other brands that were franchising their business, people I already knew and had relationships with, and they knew that I understood franchising. So I started serving on boards, started doing what I would say is some lightweight consulting, and had some investment opportunities, invested in some brands, franchised them off, and then sold to companies. So I had more experience, you know, building and converting and developing and then selling off. Through the 2000s and into 2010, after the recession, you know, everything kind of changed here. And for me personally, our family made some, estate planning decisions, and we reinvested into some more commercial real estate, which is a business we had. And I had been a property manager for years in college. And so we expanded our family business into more commercial property. And so I needed to focus some time on that. So I wound up transitioning myself out of the PostNet as a franchisee. I sold my units and converted my contract back to corporate, and then I actually got hired by the corporate office out of Denver as a headquarters staff person. So I did what I would call a part-time. I had a two-year arrangement with them. I was a strategic business advisor for the PostNet corporate office, and I did all my work from here in St. Paul.
Let's park on that for just one second,
yeah.
John, and remind our audience that they are tuned to Franchise Today. I'm Stan Friedman along with Paul Segretto, and we're talking to John Francis, a.k.a. Johnny Francis, who has unpacked for us over the past 15 or so minutes a great deal of the foundation that brings him to the place that today's topic is really designed to talk about, which is, you know, paying it forward in franchising. And you've clearly demonstrated through an impressive and diverse resume, John, the ability that you've got to have a voice that's viewed as an expert. And before we get into talking about some of the looking forward and paying it forward, I just want to remind the audience that Franchise Today is brought to you by the Franchise Foundry, a business accelerator that helps early-stage franchise systems stand up and emerging franchise brands move forward. The Franchise Foundry is headquartered in Houston, Texas, headed by co-host Paul Segretto. Franchise Today is also brought to you by yours truly and FRM Solutions, where we offer robust, out-of-the-box CRM and content management software solutions tailored specifically to the needs of franchisors for the management of their relationships with both prospective and existing franchisees. And just a little shameless plug, I might call your attention to the November issue of Franchising World, where I've got a byline article talking about CRM and sustainable growth and how you can use CRM as a tool for both emerging and franchisors that are more legacy and established with their brands to really put the word sustainable in front of growth by systematizing your businesses. And John, I want to ask you, with all the foundation that you've laid, how, if you could tell us, with all of the things that you have such expertise in, you now sit on boards, you advise companies like Sports Clips and PostNet and Big Frog and others. You've been honored, even outside of the industry, by publications like the Minneapolis Business Journal as a 40 under 40 kind of guy to watch. If you were to advise an emerging franchisor today, the one thing overall, if you could only leave them with, as Schnell would call it, one nugget that could impact their businesses immediately, whether they had deep pockets or no money at all, what would the one thing be that you would point to first and foremost in advising an emerging brand on the way forward in this economy and in this environment that we're in?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the one thing I would say is focus on the success of your franchisees. If there's one fundamental truth in franchising, it's if your franchisees are successful, you'll be successful, franchisor and supplier. If your franchisees struggle, you'll never be successful. You'll never have tremendous success, long-term, sustainable, enjoyable success if your franchisees are not happy. So franchisee and happy means a lot of different things. Not it's economics, but there's much more to it than just making money. It's got to be, and the more dimensions of happiness you can create for your franchisees, the faster and more fun you're going to have to grow that business. And I've served on a lot of different boards. I've helped a lot of different brands with a lot of different things. And like I said, I'm in a position now, I'm lucky and blessed and grateful, so I can kind of do what I like to do and help where I think I can. And if I can't, I'm honest and pretty direct and say, you know, look, this is not for me. You know, you need to talk to somebody else or try and point them in the right direction. But there's a tremendous amount of emerging brands out there these days that are growing and trying to do everything they can to be the latest and greatest in high tech and all the different things that people can get distracted with. But the bottom line, it comes down to your franchisees. They have to be successful. If you focus on their success, your success will follow. If you're focused on anything else, you're going to shorten your curve to you're going to lengthen your path to success. You know, it's a franchisee focus is where it starts. And I guess I want to talk about the issues. You know, you guys started with the NLRB and, you know, the regulation that's coming down out of Washington and in the political environment and in this economic environment. You know, it's tough out there. to be a franchisee. And you know, I had units in different states, and today I work with franchisees and the brands I'm involved with all over the place. I mean, and, you know, when I get involved in a brand, I don't just show up and ask questions. I mean, I want to learn and understand and really get comfortable and familiar with the brand and the people and their systems and how they operate their units. You know, I attend their conferences. I talk to their franchisees. I talk to their vendors. I really want to understand what's going on inside that brand. And that's not just at the corporate office. That's all the way through the organization. So I do get to see and hear and talk to franchisees who are dealing with this kind of stuff. And what I'm finding is, you know, these kind of regulations are they're taking the fun out of it, I guess, is what I would say. They're making it so much more difficult for the franchisees to compete. And they're being treated as if they're some large public company, you know, or have a huge amount of infrastructure and the capacity to just pay and continue to pay for the regulation and the reporting requirements. And I mean, it just is really, in my personal opinion, it just takes the fun out of doing business. When you have, and next time you turn around, there's one more form or a report or some other regulation has changed, and you have to go defend yourself against the regulation rather than the regulation protecting people or consumers or other kind of forms of wrongdoing. It's more of an exercise in just making sure that you're legit. And so I'm seeing that those kind of things, you know, the minimum wage thing. I've talked to franchisees in Seattle, and we had an action here in Minneapolis. I've talked to franchisees in Arizona where they're dealing with these sorts of things, and they say, you know, what are we supposed to do? If I'm on this side of the street, I'm in the city limits, and I got to pay the rates. But my competitor, who's across the street, is outside of the city limits, and he can pay whatever he wants to pay. You know, these kind of complications, I mean, I could debate the whole minimum wage strategy, and it's on the face of it, I think it's a misdirected priority. But the fact is that the regulation and the restrictions and the complexity that comes with it is really causing, making it real difficult for people to stay competitive as business owners. And especially as franchisees that are in, you know, that danger zone. You know, if you're, and I mean by that, I mean it depends on the model and the brand and the, you know, the person, frankly, running the franchisee. But, you know, a single unit owner is a single unit owner, and they're usually in there behind the counter or under the hood or whatever. They're doing the work, and they're running that single store. And that's the vast majority, I think, of franchisees out there. But now over the last 5 or 10 years, we've all seen the trend towards multiple unit owners where guys want to own 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 or however many of whatever brand or model it may be. As you grow through that single unit into that multi-unit, there's a valley in there. I say, you know, it's easy, relatively easy having 1 or 2 stores because you can kind of do it all and you fly under the radar. And most of this regulation doesn't necessarily apply. But when you hit a certain level, maybe it's between 3 and 5 or 10 units, until you get up, till you can scale to the level where you can really afford to outsource and manage a lot of that complexity and regulation and just the insurance requirements. You know, it's a real obstacle. So it's very difficult for franchisees to grow to the level where they want to, and these kind of regulations are really stifling that growth and, frankly, making it more expensive, more difficult, and slowing down the growth of these small business owners. So I see it at a lot of levels, and, you know, I was just on a call here yesterday with one of my boards and talking to the CFO, and I'm like, what are your big issues for the year? Because, we're talking next year. And Affordable Care Act. And I said, well, where you been on that? Because we've been watching it come for years. And he said, right. Well, you know, we weren't sure because it got litigated and it went through the whole Supreme Court thing, and everyone, they were optimistic it might get overturned or somehow delayed. I mean, they were changing the rules as they go. And now I said, well, look, we're here now, and I don't think anyone expects it to really go away. You know, you got to catch up. And the conclusion we came to is he can't. He can't catch up. He's not going to do it inside. And this is a smaller brand. It's not a national brand. I would call it a regional brand. But they've got outsource. So they're looking at and evaluating their choices. There are not a whole variety of vendors and companies that would love to be their supplier and provider for those kind of solutions. But it's the fact is the regulations cause a huge delay and a distraction and a significant expense.
Yeah, they should be. Mm-hmm. You know, John, we've seen and we've talked on the show the last few weeks about technology replacing some of these entry-level jobs. We've talked about, you know, McDonald's rolling out, you know, kiosks at the counter and plans to do so at 2,000 locations in 2016 where people will walk up and place their order. So obviously it'll reduce, you know, staff. Chili's had done that. Buffalo Wild Wings done it just yesterday, even in a full-service capacity. Olive Garden now has rolling out tablets on the tables to minimize, you know, staff. So we see this whole trend going in this direction in fast food and other food service businesses where they're able to replace some of this wait staff and be able to, you know, be able to afford some of the increase with some of the people back at the house or in mid-level management position. But, you know, your background, you know, going into, you know, personal services and hair cutting, you can't replace that with technology.
No, not today.
So how is that going to affect that type of business?
Well, you know, the secret in the salon industry, I mean, well, and it's not just the salon industry. I mean, I think it's just about any service business. It's people. You got to have the right people providing good quality service consistently. And in a haircut environment, it may not be the greatest haircut, but you know how you were treated, right? I mean, if the staff is not, you know, doing their job or feeling good about it, you know, you're gonna. It doesn't matter how great the cut might be. If you were not treated properly or didn't feel good about the service, you know, it's beyond the haircut. So what I'm seeing other brands do now is a real focus on scheduling efficiency because, you know, the regulations and the hourly, you know, the totals and keeping so many people under so many hours per week and triggering all the different layers of regulation and the reporting that goes into it. There are some other technologies I'm seeing emerge now that are becoming more important where they're specifically focused on scheduling and flexibility in scheduling, but with technology around it so that it controls the, I would say, the rules, if you will. So a staff person is only allowed to work so many shifts or so many hours in a given week, and the system accommodates those kind of controls so that the ownership, the manager, or the franchisee in most cases, can balance that schedule. So if you may have an army of staff and they all want flex time, but they all want to be busy when they're working, nobody wants to stand around. You know, and having the technology that helps facilitate that flexible scheduling so that when you see your demand go up, you call in the staff as you need it, and as you see the demand go down, you know, the staff, the schedules are modified. Now, we had a thing here in Minneapolis. I don't know if this made much of the national news, but there was an effort here, another regulation campaign called the Fair Scheduling Act, and or something of that nature. It was kind of a joke, and I saw it. And I said, "You got to be kidding me!" It was a Minneapolis city thing. It was trying to make a rule that employers had to post the schedule 2 weeks in advance, or what? Some I don't remember, and they couldn't change it. And if they did change it, they had to pay, you know, the employees some kind of extra rates. It was just this onerous, difficult, I mean, unreasonable, unrealistic. It just eliminated the ability for the ownership to manage their business. And thankfully, there was enough pushback and people realized this is ridiculous and how are you ever going to manage it and enforce it? It was unfair and just unreasonable. And it didn't go anywhere. I think it went away. But it just shows how people think that if there's some way that the workers are being treated unfairly or you know, let's pass a law and make a regulation. And the regulation affects everybody, not just the one incident where there was an issue. You know, it's just becomes just unnecessarily complicated. So I'm seeing these regulations and I'm seeing the impact on the business owners and do a good job and treat their people right. You know, generally speaking, people want to do the right thing for the right reasons. But when the regulation gets in the way, you know, like I said, from my point of view, it takes all the fun out of it. mean, what's the point then? You know, why am I in business anymore? Just to fill out forms and paperwork? Or is it to really serve my customers and develop my people and grow a business? So it's an ongoing challenge, and I don't see it going the other way. I see it getting more complicated. I see the adjustments coming further down into the smaller businesses, not just the huge businesses. And I think the trend is disheartening, frankly. And I think that the way that franchisees and franchises are being lumped in and not identified as individual independent owners, you know, that's a disadvantage. And I know the IFA, our association, is involved in trying to deal with some of these things, and it just seems to be coming at the owners from all angles, from the national level, state level, from a city regulation,
yep,
you know, whether it's payroll, HR, scheduling. I mean, it's just insurance.
You know what I think we need to do? I think, Paul, and I think I'm thinking ahead, and usually neither you or I make decisions on who we're going to have on this program without consulting each other first. But since John is already here, I'm going to make a suggestion, and that is we could spend hours with you, John, on any one of these topics because of the depth of your history and your background and your insight. Given that we have this December 11th vote upcoming,
yeah,
I'm gonna ask Paul to excuse me for taking protocol and tossing it, but I think after the first of the year, John, I think we need to bring you back and spend another segment or another program talking about the outcome, or probably talking about what we don't know to be the outcome yet, but what the impact of the outcome of this vote will be on December 11th, whichever way it goes.
Yeah, I think that'll be good.
And take a look into 2016 on the front end of the year, because time has really killed us here, and we've about eclipsed it, but I don't think we're anywhere near the end of the story. So would you agree to do that with us, John?
Yeah, no, sure, Stan. I appreciate that. I'd be happy to come back or add more value. You know, I think the reality is that these regulations and these things are all kind of, it's like a death by a thousand cuts. You know, it's a slow, steady push, and it makes it more and more difficult. And I see franchisees, you know, they're pretty innovative. They're smart people. Business owners are resilient. They want to do the right thing. They stick with it. And the good franchisors are trying to navigate some rocky waters, too. There's a certain amount of, you know, this vicarious liability or joint employer and all the rest. They want to help, but they don't want to go too far because then maybe they have a liability exposure. And there's techniques and differing opinions on really what level of support and how it should be structured. But doing
nothing is not an option. And no matter what you do or don't do, you've got to do something. So,
right.
At this point, I'm afraid I have to do this. I have to say, John, this has been enlightening and entertaining and informative. And I hope you'll come back with us in January and let's take a look at what that vote was on the 11th and then maybe put on the crystal ball and take a look forward at what it's going to mean for us in the year ahead. Paul, anything to add?
I think that would be great. No, I think that would be great, John. I really appreciate your time with us today. It definitely was enlightening and very informative. And like Stan said, I think we just opened the door for continued conversation. So I think for agreeing to come back in January, we'll circle back.
Yeah, I'm happy to share more, and I'm glad it's useful for you. You know, Stan, I can go on and on, and I want to make sure we stay focused and on time.
Well, I'm good with that, and I'm glad that you'll come back in January. Paul, what do we want to do for the back of the house today? Any business to share?
You know, franchise is slowing down as far as events coming up, conferences and what have you.
It's about time, don't you think?
Yeah, it is about time. I mean, they're racking up those major miles. You need to slow down a little bit. You know, we got two great guests to wrap up this year our franchise today. Next week we have Lynette McKee, and the following week we have Catherine Bonson. What a great way to wrap up 2015 on Franchise Today.
Could not agree with you more. Two of my favorite professionals in franchising and two aspirational guests who have done an incredible amount to not just inspire others that are executives in franchising, but both in leadership roles as women in franchising who have really taken the mantle and run with it. They've got a lot to share, and I'm looking forward to our conversations with both. My big regret for the year, Paul, is my missing last week's program and not having an opportunity to enjoy part of that interview as the interviewer with Shelley Sun. Thank you for taking up the role for me, the mantle for me, as I was just finishing up with the Emerging Franchisor Conference down in Miami. But and thanks again to Shelley, too, for being our guest. And, Shelley, my apologies for not being here with you.
And I did have a question that you were going to ask her, Stan, about aspirations for political office. She laughed and said, absolutely not.
I'm sure the Colly Fiorina said that at some point in her career, too. But we'll leave that alone for now, won't we?
Yes, we will. And before we sign off, I do want to thank the almost 500 people that on Thanksgiving Day, on Saturday and Sunday of holiday weekend, listened in on Franchise Today via on-demand access through Blog Talk Radio and iTunes. And I think that's a testament to us paying it because we believe with this great content and the great guests that we have providing us with great content, so many are finding it very, very useful. I'm looking forward to wrapping up the year, as I said, with two great guests, with you, Stan, as the co-host as we enter year number 7 on Franchise Today. And I have a very strong feeling it is going to be lucky 7.
There you go. So, awesome. Well, thank you, Paul. Another great week, and enjoyed rolling it out with John Francis. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that vote goes on the 11th and then having John back here, because the implications of what comes as the result of that December 11th vote, who better than a guy who's been on both sides of the street and has the insights that he does to help maybe help us understand how best to navigate whatever it is we learn after that vote's taken.
Absolutely. Stan, until next week, and everybody, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great, great thing we call franchising, and Franchise Today is...